Do you know what it takes to sell your business for seven or eight figures? Hi, I'm Jared Krause. I'm the host of the Buying Online Businesses podcast. And today I'm speaking with Paul Avens, who coaches entrepreneurs and CEOs how to scale up their sales, profits, and shareholder value to prepare their business for seven and eight figure exits. Now, in this podcast episode, Paul and I dive into acquiring businesses and a few tales that Paul has around acquisitions for himself personally. We also discuss the difference between owning a business, being an operator, being an investor, and how they're all very different. We also dive into the difference between the skills needed to start a business, the skills needed to grow a business, and the skills need to be operator and owner and or sell the business. So there's massive differences in those. We also talk about an example of how he helped scale an e-commerce brand and how long it actually took them to do, what the things were that they need to put in place to be able to get more distribution and sell more products to existing clients, new clients. We also talk about how to prepare your business for an exit. The things that you need to be thinking about, the timelines you need to set in place, and the things you need to do to get the highest possible exit or price for your business. We also discuss how to carry yourself through the selling stage of the business and the common pitfalls and traps that entrepreneurs can face whilst they're trying to sell their business and run their business at the same time. And lastly, Paul shares his tales of two different entrepreneurs that Paul is very impressed by and what we can learn from those two people and their character in how they show up as entrepreneurs. Now, this is such a valuable episode. We do talk about buying businesses. If you are wanting to buy a business and you haven't got my due diligence framework, what are you even doing? I give it away for free. It's helped me make a lot of money. It's helped my clients make a lot of money and saved us millions of dollars as well. Now, get that at buyingonlinebusinesses.com/free resources and let's dive into the pod. Do you have a website you might want to sell either now or in the future? We have a hungry list of cashed up and trained up buyers that want to buy your content website. If you have a site making over $300 per month and want to sell it, head to buyingonlinebusinesses.co/sell-your-business or email us at info@buyingonlinebusinesses.com because we will likely have a buyer. Details are in the description. Paul. So good to be talking to you. Thanks for coming on this pod.
Oh, listen, it's a real privilege and a pleasure. And thank you for the opportunity to share. So I'm looking forward to this conversation, actually. I'm really excited for this one.
Yeah, me too. I mean, when I found out about you, I was like, yes, we need to talk about how you've helped CEOs and entrepreneurs scale in terms of how to get ready for an exit. And that's an issue what I wanted to, pick your brain about. Before we hit the record buttons off air, what people don't know is that you mentioned, you've helped people buy a bunch of businesses before as well. You bought businesses yourself. Congrats. Why, I want to ask why. Why did you buy a business, or have you bought multiple, or what's your motivation for that?
Good question. I've done pretty much all of them now. So I've done startups with funding, raising venture capital. I've done startups with credit card debt. I've done done scale ups myself. I've done joint ventures. I've done buying businesses out of administration, or sort of out of Chapter 11 bankruptcy, and then scaling and selling them. I've done that. I like to say I've done the whole wheel of business, which includes having failures, right? So I'm really honest and open and transparent about this. I've had two fairly painful business failures in my career. One which took me nearly cost me not just my a lot of money, but my health and my life and all those things with the stress of it all. So I've kind of done the whole cycle. And for me, there's just such a great opportunity when you can acquire something that's reached the limit of the kind of the entrepreneur who started it, their kind of like skill set. And I think it's a very different type of skill set between starting something and commercializing it, which is getting it to the point at which it can actually make revenue and money, and then scaling it and getting it ready for exit. And I think they're two, and this isn't something, it's taken me a long time to realize this. They're very different skill sets, right? They're really different. And So it took me ages to figure this out, right? Personally. So just for context, yes, I've been business coaching for 20 years. I now don't really call it business coaching. I call it scale up coaching because I think it's a very different thing that we do that other people don't. I'm not talking about making people really good at operationalizing their business. There's lots of people out there that do that. I'm talking about how do we help you scale your business, build what I call a grown up business that has tangible value that someone is prepared to pay for in cash, right? Or pay for with money, right? Like the biggest single thing that most entrepreneurs are doing is they run this program that says, hey, one day I will sell, because this has all got to be worth it. And the staggering stats that really shocked me is less than eight, certainly in the UK, less than 18% of businesses that go up for sale ever sell. So that means there is this enormous amount of people who are building a or running a business, thinking they are building a business and thinking at some point at the end of the rainbow, someone's going to come along and offer them a ton of money for it. And that's usually their pension plan. It's usually their biggest financial investment is in their business, time, energy, money. Most entrepreneurs will sacrifice a lot to build something significant. And I'm talking seven figures and above. So I specialize in helping people go from sort of $500,000 or $1 million and up to 25 and exit, right? That's kind of the space I operate in, because we've got a proven model at that point. But I think too many people don't understand. And I've been in rooms where this conversation has happened. Somebody has looked at the business and gone, it's not worth very much money. And the entrepreneur has got really upset because they're like, you don't understand. I've spent 25 years building it. And actually what they didn't understand was they'd spent 25 years running it, not building it to exit it. And they're two very different strategies. And this is why I'm passionate about three things, right? Strategy, talent, and cash. You've got to have a clear strategy. You've got, which may include acquisitions, absolutely, and should do. You've got to have the right team around you, or you're never going to exit. And thirdly, you've got to have the right commercial model, the cash that generates the right cash, to be able to exit in any way, shape, or form. So if any of those three aren't present, I normally have a tripod on my desk. It's a bit like a tripod, right? Oh, here we go. Here's one I made earlier, right? It's like a tripod. If any one of those three isn't working, it falls over, right? It falls over. So this is what most business owners go through. And I've been through this pain of thinking, if I just focus on the money, or if I just focus on sales, or if I just, you know, rather than realizing we need to get good at building all three. We need a clear strategy. We need the right talent, the right team. And that's a critical skill set. And that's not what it takes to get a business off the ground, generate sales and prove a concept and figure out whether there's product market fit. That's one skill set. Then scaling it, totally different.
Yeah, I'm with you. I'm absolutely with you. I have a lot of people come to me as like, Jared, well, why should I buy a business when I don't know how to start one or run one? Well, you don't need to. Like, typically you can have people, when you acquire a business, you can have people that's already operating it and somebody else has already started it. What you do need to do if you want to be the operator, there's a difference between operator and owner, and I'll talk about that in a second, based on what you just mentioned, is that, you know, you can be the owner, you can acquire the business and have an operator put in place and make sure you hold the operator accountable to scaling. Now, when you said 18% of businesses that go up for sale sell in the UK, my assumption is that they're probably brick and mortar offline businesses more so than digital assets. I'm sure there's a bunch of assets that are online businesses that go up for sale that don't sell because they're not great. But for the offline assets, my assumption is probably because you've got these people that have built these businesses, but what they've actually built for themselves is a job, and nobody wants to buy a job, right? Like, that's what the book, the E-Myth, is really, you know, highlights the difference. And if you guys haven't heard of the E-Myth, it's by Michael Gerber. I'm sure you have, Paul. It's massive.
I spoke on stage with him, actually. Stage with Michael Gerber.
Yeah.
So I think there's a point you just started to jump in. Wait, he's a really nice guy. The E-Myth is brilliant. However, the E-Myth doesn't, in my opinion, it talks to a different time and a different age. So it doesn't talk to digital businesses right now in the same way, because the E-Myth was mainly going, look, you need to view your business like a franchise prototype, like you're about to have 50 of them or 100 of them, and, you know, which is fine and it's great. And that's a good frame to start the conversation with. I prefer to start the conversation with, you know, you need to decide if you're going to be an operator, an owner, or an investor. And they're three different things, right? And for me, the challenge with Michael Gerber's stuff now is that in the digital world, and this is why I think a lot of businesses that are going up for sale are physical right now, is because the vast majority of people who are hitting retirement age built physical businesses. So people who, you know, I've got clients of mine who just bought a language school or just bought a body shop or just bought a glasses manufacturing business in the UK, like they're physical businesses. And all of the people who ran those and started those are hitting retirement. They're sort of 58, 60, 64. They want to retire. So that generation and that those assets are now coming to the marketplace. That's happening a lot. Where I think there's an actual bigger opportunity is because most of the digital assets that have been created by people who fundamentally are not really driven to scale it big, my opinion, my take, and that's a massive assumption, but I'm just going to, that's my experience so far, right? But they're very good at getting it off the ground and hustling and getting it started, but the skill set to scale it, they don't have that. And therefore they're like, well, can somebody just take this on and scale it? And I think that's why for me, and I'm looking at this, I said to you before, I'm looking at this commercially right now. I think buying digital assets that have massive scalable potential, if you understand how to scale something, it's just starting up as a big opportunity, I think. I think we're at the beginning of a massive wave of opportunity with that.
I mean, I agree. I have been doing this for a long time, many, many years. As soon as funding becomes more available for digital assets, this thing's going to go ridiculous. Multiples are going to go higher and people are going to be focusing more on online businesses and the acquisitions of online businesses, the M&A world of online business. Now, it's very interesting, like you said, the opportunity that is available with just digital, but also, you know, it's vice versa as well. Like somebody that has bought an e-commerce business, the opportunity of them going away and creating their own manufacturing plant and running that business as well as having, you know, their digital sales arm attached to it is huge. You know, they can cut costs, they can produce faster, better products by, you know, maybe acquiring a manufacturing arm for their business, and it could be an offline asset. And the same goes with people that, you know, you said you've helped people buy, you know, there was a $14 million deal that you guys bought for no money down recently that you mentioned. Now, I know that, you know, there's caveats with that story, of course.
That's not common. Just to be really clear, that's very rare. This is the first time I've seen any of our clients do an eight-figure deal. It took 2 years to put together. But here's the lesson for me around that. There's loads, but here's one of them is we were very clear on the growth strategy. We got to, I mean, that business nearly, for context, that business was on the verge of being bankrupt 4 years ago because of COVID.
Nobody gets
$22 million.
$0 without it being distressed.
Yeah. You make a really good point here, and I don't think this gets talked about enough. I don't like buying distressed businesses, and I don't encourage clients to buy distressed businesses because they are a massive drain. And if you've done one, and I have, they're enormously draining and distracting. And what you actually want to do is strategically add something to a model that is already working, and then that accelerates it. So that £14 million acquisition, the business was at 7 million, has a great leadership team, has an amazing CEO, has funding, has a massive customer base and huge demand. Therefore, the acquisition, you go, look, that's a 21, £22 million business when it's done. And then in 12 to 18 months, it's going to be a £30 million business. And at that point, it's the biggest in Europe.
Yeah. Yeah. It's I'm with you 100%. It's less resources in all resources, time, capacity, focus, marketing, team, talent, all that sort of stuff. Less resources need to go into something that is already stable to get it to scale a lot more than to turn something around. Because what's coming down, like it's just like a physical law, I mean, or a natural law, is that what's coming down really fast, like to get it to go to change directory, there's so many more resources you need to put, like 2 to 3 or more times resources to put it in just to turn that trajectory around. Now, I just had
I feel that one at the moment. I've just gone through one where I fall into this trap, just to be clear, right? I fall into the ambition over logic trap sometimes, and I can see upside, and sometimes I ignore downside. And I think if you've never bought a business before, here's the biggest thing I would say, that there are two or three things that I would always caution people about. Number one, buy something that you have a real interest in, because this is going to take a lot of your time and energy and attention. So don't buy something you're not interested in. Number two, the team and the customer, the team are really critical, right? If you're buying anything, it doesn't matter whether there's only two or three people. If it's an online platform or it's outsourced, you're still going to need people. So you've got to be really clear about who you want to work with. And thirdly, like, got to get really comfortable with, right, what are the growth opportunities in the business that you're buying? Like, if you buy it, are you really clear? This is why I start with strategy all the time, is that are you really clear that, like, okay, first of all, don't do anything for the first 100 days, right? I always say that to everyone who buys a business. Do not change anything for 100 days, right? Just don't, because you don't know what works. Yeah. You got to get to know the people. You got to get to know what's working. Now, I'll give you my favorite thing to tell clients to do in the first sort of like 30 days is to go in and get the existing team to give a list of all the things that are currently frustrating them. Right? Like, and some of them you can fix for like pennies on the dollar. Right? So, when I bought a PPC agency out of administration, and I sat out of sort of bankruptcy. It wasn't bankrupt, but it was close to. But, and I sat down with the team and I went, right, what's all the things that are annoying you? And they gave me a list. And at the top of their list was the fact that they only had one screen, they wanted two, and the fact that they didn't have stands for the screen, so their necks were hurting, their backs were hurting. And I was like, right, we got them two monitors each. We got them proper stands and proper chairs. And all in, that probably cost $1,000. Not even that, right? The goodwill that bought me for changes I wanted to make down the road was enormous, because they were like, this guy really cares about us. This guy's just fixed things that have been annoying us for ages, and the last owner never fixed. And therefore, suddenly you go, okay, well, I've got emotional equity with the team. They trust me now, right? Because the hardest thing when you buy a business is people don't trust you. Right? They don't trust you. They're like, what are your motives? Why are you here? What are you like? Are you going to be better than the last person who owned the company? Are you going to be worse? Are you going to be, you know, they don't. And that creates this, you have to build trust in the first 30 days. And that requires emotional, it requires going in and fixing things that have been annoying them that honestly, most of the time, they're really easy to fix.
Yeah, I love that. And people might, you know, hopefully you're not hearing this, that it's only a thing with an offline business. That can be done in digital businesses too, with your team as well. You know, like, I know people that sit down with their team and every once a week, and they buy everybody food, they get it delivered, and they have one big party every week, you know, or every month. And that there's so many things that you can do, you know, for birthdays, for people and all that sort of stuff with a digital team. But you know, then, like what you said, Paul, is like they've got your trust, and then they believe in your vision as well, because you've earned their trust, and then they're just going to work so much. You can't measure the goodwill. It's really hard to measure that, like, tangibly. So yeah, where to go from here in the pod? I mean, it's been an exciting ride of talking about acquisitions, but once somebody has acquired a business, and we establish that you don't need to know how to start a business and or only operate. You can learn to operate, and then you can have people come in with a strategy. Now, how do you help people once they've acquired a business to get that scalability to an exit? What are some of the things that you put in place? I mean, so I think three pillars. Maybe we go through each of those three pillars. Or those three.
Yeah, we can absolutely do that. I mean, I've got a different framework which we can talk about. I just want to talk about the mindset piece around how you see yourself when you buy a business, because I think this is where a lot of people get caught, and I got caught, right? So if you buy a business and you're undercapitalized. Let's use that term. So you've done it, but maybe you've done it on debt financing. Maybe you've done it on deferred consideration. So you're paying for over 2 or 3 years out of profits, you know, whatever the deal structure is that you've done. And I think you spoke to a really interesting point at the moment. Most of the banks, certainly in the UK and stuff, are not funding digital assets, right? They don't see value in that yet. They still fund physical assets, but they don't really get digital assets yet. I think that's coming. And I think outside the UK, it might be easier, but in the UK, it's quite hard to get, you know, e-commerce sites and stuff funded. It's not as easy. The banks don't, they don't get it yet, right? Partly because the generation of people who are in the top of the banks are used to physical things they can see, feel, touch, and chart, and put a charge over, right? But that's just the reality. I try not to, in case I ever need to borrow money off them, and I don't want them finding out that I did that publicly. But yeah, I think they're behind the times. Let's put it politely, right? But I think here's the thing. So I've always said that if you call yourself, and I'll use the UK language because it's different around the world, but if you call yourself a managing director or an owner, I don't think that's the right job title. I think the reason why I say you should call yourself a CEO is because CEO for me stands, your job is to be creating expansion opportunities. That's your job. You should be constantly looking at how do we grow this business, not how do we just run it. Okay, so that's why your number two, your COO, even if they're not called that, they could be called a general manager, right? Who, even in a digital world, somebody has to be the operational expert. Your job is to focus out, not focus in, right? Now, at the very beginning, yes, you might need to focus in, but once you're on board, your job should be, right, where are the growth opportunities? What are the market sectors? And what's the strategy for driving growth? And there are, you know, there's only really kind of four things that you can look at. You know, are we selling existing products to existing customers? Easy way to make cash in the first instance. Are we selling existing products to new markets? Are we creating new products for existing customers, or are we creating new products for new markets? And new products for new markets is the highest risk, most dangerous thing you can do. So if you've got those four strategic growth drivers, which order are you using them in, and then how are you going to do that? You can be an e-com business and it still applies. So I've got an e-commerce client that we've worked with for the last 2 years, and we've grown that business from $500,000 to $2.1 million in 2 years. Organic. That's all organic, no acquisitions, right? So and that's been about taking existing product and taking it to new markets. So we've taken it to 17 new territories around the world, right? We found distributors and partners in 17 different territories. And then we've done new products to existing customer base. So they've just got a million subscribers on YouTube on their channel, that they built their platform out, they've got this massive customer base, they've got about 100,000 people on email. So now we can launch new product to existing customer base, because that's an easier way to generate cash. So we've done two things. We've taken does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I would start, like, if it was me personally and I was a chief expansion officer, if you'd want to call it that. I just thought of that when you said, you know, your CEO should be thinking about expansion. Why not call it chief expansion officer instead of executive? So with that, if I was the CEO, I would probably go with, you know, going for new products to existing audience, but first do like a survey, work out what their wants, needs, fears, frustrations, desire, and actually build a product that they tell us to build so it sells like hotcakes. Use that money to roll that over into expansion of market share, you know, acquiring more market share for existing products that are bestsellers. Because who knows, maybe this new product that you created could become your new bestseller that you need to, you know, use with your new partners that you create in terms of distribution network. So I want to ask, how did you, with this, let's use this e-commerce brand as a sort of case study and example. It's going to be relevant to everybody listening. How did you go about, you know, expanding to new markets and acquiring partnerships? What did that look like for you guys?
So there were two or three. So first things first is, you know, when I talk about scale, the first part of that is they have a really clear strategy. So we created a 2 to 3 year expansion plan that basically says, for the next 2 years, these are the key drivers of growth. This is where we're doing. These are the market opportunities that we see. And then we got really clear. So that's the strategy, right? Strategy is to take existing product to new market, and then to create new product for existing customers. They were the two strategies, right? So then you say, that's C. So that's strategy, right? Then C is for customers, right? So who are the customers and what are the channels? So C for me in scale is who are the customers we want to target and where are the channels we're going to find them. So once we're really clear on the channels, and interestingly, LinkedIn was where we found a lot of distributors around the world, because we were able to find them online and then we were able to kind of like connect with them. We started putting out a lot of content on LinkedIn, and he hadn't done that before. We even put out a lot, they went viral on TikTok, and that got them half a dozen distributors. So what's really interesting is whilst TikTok didn't get them a lot of customers, TikTok did get them visibility and did get them distributors. So, and then we had retailers. So we had distributors, retailers, and end user customers. So we had these three customer groups that we were targeting, right? So end user customers is B2C. So we focused on Amazon as the main channel. So Amazon became the big thing. We went in on massively on that. We hadn't gone into the US, Amazon on US. So that became an obvious thing to do, is to take what's working in the Amazon in the UK and Europe and then move it into the US. So that's a leverage. That's a great piece of leverage. Massive. And then we went, okay, who are the top 10 retailers in the US? How many are we currently dealing with? We were dealing with like five, maybe. I can't remember exactly. Who are the top three or four sports retailers in the US, and how do we get to them? And there's an interesting story here, right? Because this is the power of asking for help and power of network, okay? So we were trying to get in, I won't say the name of the retailer, but let's just say the biggest sports retailer in the US, right? It's massive. It's huge, right? and we were trying to get to the buyer in that organization. And no matter what we did, we couldn't get them to respond, or my client couldn't get them to respond, right? So like we tried letters, we tried DMs, we tried all kinds of stuff, right? And just nothing. Nobody would bite. We'd send samples. We'd done all of that stuff and nobody was biting at all. No response. So in the end, we found like two key people that we figured in the organization were involved in new product listing and all the rest of it. And we basically went on LinkedIn and asked for help from my client's network and said, does anybody in my network know these two people? Tagged them in, because we just want a 10-minute conversation with them. That's it. We just want 10 minutes with them, and that's it. Can anybody get us an introduction? And we got three introductions off the back of that LinkedIn post. So sometimes it's just going, right, okay, you've got to be really clear about who you're trying to target and then ask for help from your network, because 9 times out of 10, your network will either know somebody or know, you know, be able to introduce you. And that's now become a key account and potentially could be huge this year for the business, right? But you've got to be really strategic with who are the top 10 or 15, if you're going distributors or retailers. You know, what's your B2C play? So what's your direct to consumer play? What's your distributor play? So who are the distributors? And then what's your kind of like, are you doing OEM? So are you doing white label and letting other people, you know, sell your products through their channels? So getting really clear on the customers you're talking to and the channel strategies that you're using becomes really, really critical. And then it's about creating the right assets to attract the people you want to do business with. So YouTube channel became a massive thing for them. They just hit a million followers on YouTube, subscribers and subs on YouTube. TikTok became really great for building brand awareness. Instagram videos, Instagram shorts, Instagram reels became massive for them. So we kind of went, those are the three channels to build brand awareness. And then LinkedIn was the outreach channel. So whilst content wasn't massive on LinkedIn, LinkedIn was the outreach where we'd post some content on LinkedIn, but nowhere near as much as on YouTube, Instagram or TikTok. But LinkedIn was the outreach relationship builders, because we could find them, we could find the right people to talk to, and we could connect with them and then set up conversations. So we were really strategic with that decision about, right, what's our direct to consumer play? What's our channel strategy? And what's our kind of country partner strategy? So that was really clear. And then when you've got that, you can then focus on what assets do we need to create, like brochures, collateral, marketing campaigns. That's the assets. Then, okay, great. How do we leverage this on a massive scale? How do we leverage this to you know, so do we have salespeople on the road in country knocking on doors? In fact, one of the things that really worked, because most people don't want to do this with e-commerce businesses, my client did two or three big road trips where he just like went round Europe and visited all the distributors, like literally got on a plane and then train and then spent like 3 weeks on the road creating content while he went, but visiting people face to face, because people forget that they want to do everything online. And actually, do you know what? I just came back from Dubai. And part of the reason was because I wanted to get on a plane and go and meet people and shake hands and network. And that you have to, you know, the old salesperson in me says you have to burn the shoe leather, right? Sometimes you have to go and do the hard yards and go and meet people and shake people's hands. You can't get into a country if you're not prepared to get on the plane and go meet the major players in that country and go talk to them. And I think even if you're an online business, do not be afraid to go face to face and meet people to convert people if it's strategically thought out.
Yeah, and it's going to provide the ROI, you know, like for one person to go away and do that, and they might do it over a couple of months for what, you know, a couple of accounts that could be opened or distribution channels that could make millions of dollars, you know, it's going to provide a great ROI.
Yeah, completely. But you also learn so much more when you're sat in a room. If you're sat in a room with a customer, a potential customer talking about your products, you're going to get more feedback. You learn much quicker. You refine the messaging that filters through to the marketing that you're putting out. And there is just this thing. It's like relationship depth is built face to face. And I think you can do Zoom calls and that's cool. But we were talking before and you were saying, hey, look, if you're ever out in Bali, in my part of the world, come see me. And I'm like, yeah, great. Let's do that. I'd love to do that. Right. Like sometimes you've got to go meet people face to face because it just accelerates trust. That's what it does. It accelerates trust in your brand, in your product, and in you as a entrepreneur that you are trustworthy. And if your competitors aren't doing it, it becomes a massive differentiator.
It's a bit of a wow factor. It's like, okay, well, like, you know, there's these distributors that are, you know, say this sports company, they've got a bunch of different people just emailing them, texting them and all that sort of stuff. And you did it through the intro, but for example, if, you know, you found them through, you know, a networking event that you got invited to, or somebody set up an introduction at a restaurant, you know, it's much different and it makes so much more of an impact. And, you know, probably you could get the wheels moving a lot faster and maybe selling more, you know, a lot faster as well. But, you know, it's all depends on what the business is, the product and the market and the distributors and all those. There's many depends, but yeah, you're right. I'm with you on the face-to-face stuff. So with that distribution, you know, or that scale that you've gotten, is there anything else that you want to mention around how you help them with scale before you move to like preparation for exit, or what you might do? Yes. To help somebody like that or a company like that prepare for exit?
Yeah, loads, but we haven't got enough time to teach you all of it. But so I'll give you a couple of critical things that I think entrepreneurs don't know they don't know. So first thing is you've got to realize that you've got to be clear on what kind of revenue you're generating. And so there's like what we call three different types of revenue, right? So the holy grail of revenue is kind of repeat recurring revenue. So people that like SaaS products or anything that's recurring where people are paying an amount of money, that's the holy grail, right? The more of that you get, the bigger your multiple gets. So if you buy a business that doesn't have a recurring revenue stream, the first thing I would be looking at with you is saying, okay, how are we going to create a recurring revenue product in this business? Because without that, there isn't a lock-in value on exit, right? So that's the first thing. Then you've got what we call kind of, there's transactional value, which is people buy once every now and again, but then there's repeat income streams. So like for his product lasts about 4 months. So customers come back every 4 months and buy. So that's repeat income. That's not recurring income, which is, you know, you're on a contract, it gets shipped every 30 days or whatever. So that's a different kind of contract. So you've got to look at the revenue and go, how much is one-off kind of revenue, kind of like transactional revenue? How much is repeat income? Because people come back to consume the product or use the product and how much is recurring? And that's really critical to understand, because if you get that mix wrong, when you go to exit, it's very hard for somebody who is trying to value your business to value it on future revenue if all your revenue, for example, is one-off revenue stream. So if it's people coming to you buying once and then they go and they don't come back, that business is very hard to give a multiple that's going to be exciting to, simply because there's no recurring revenue, right? So when I'm buying your business, I'm buying future revenue. Essentially, that's what I'm buying. I'm buying your ability to project how strong the revenue is going to be 2-3 years out. That's what I'm buying as an investor. And if the kind of sales revenue that you're making isn't solid, isn't predictable, right? And this is why distributed channels are so important, because you go direct to consumer, that you've got no real control over, that some of them buy, some of them won't. But you know, you can start to build up a really good pattern of, say, a distributor who's, you know, if they're a retailer, they order this much stock every year, and they order it every year, and that's the kind of, so that's repeat income, not recurring. Then you go, okay, how do we create a recurring income stream in this business model where people sign up and they pay $30 a month? Because if we get, you know, 15,000 people on $30 a month, the value we've just created in this business is exceptional. So understanding the kind of revenue that the business is, and that's, by the way, I'm just sharing that because that's one of the critical things I look at if somebody's looking at buying a business, is what kind of revenue are you buying? And also, how fast can we increase the recurring revenue or the repeat income? Like, how fast can we do that? So, like, I'll give you a really quick example of this. So, offline bit example, but it will make sense, right? So, a client came to me, runs four vet practices, doing about £4 million turnover a year, but they all their revenue was just people coming in whenever, right? Now, I've got another vet practice that's that I coach, 78% of all their revenue is recurring. So, you immediately look at that business and go, the 78% recurring revenue business is like five times more valuable because of that. So all we did was launch a recurring revenue product to his customer base, and suddenly we've got 20% of his revenue has gone from zero to 20% being recurring. What we've just done to the balance sheet is make that business two or three times more valuable in one marketing campaign. So we created balance sheet value. Yes, we created cash flow, critical. If you want to scale, you need to create cash flow, but we'd also create a balance sheet value because we've got recurring revenue. So the understanding the makeup of the money and how it's made up and how you can change the makeup of the money model is a critical piece in the scaling conversation. Because if you build it, if you don't build it for longevity, if you don't build it the right way, you get less of a valuation on exit. Does that make sense, Jared? I'm just checking.
Yeah. I'm with you. You know, what I see you doing is you're looking at how do I increase the multiple, and the only way to increase the multiple when you're selling a business is to make sure the business is less risky, has a lot of cash, and is very predictable. And that's, you know, through those different types of revenues and adding them or expanding those revenue streams to be just that. So I'm totally with you. I actually even know I've had a guest on the podcast talk about how to memberify e-commerce businesses to, you know, yeah, it's really cool. And that's helped, you know, typically an e-com business can sell between 1 to 3 year multiple. But if you know, add this extra revenue stream and it's, you know, a 30-day recurring thing or 60 days or whatever it is, yeah, it's you know, your multiples go way up. Really fast, like you said.
Yeah, I mean, we got this during COVID, so it's a bit skewed, right? But we have had a client exit for a 32 multiple, which is just like mind-blowing.
Annual, 32 annual multiple?
32 EBIT, yeah.
Wow. Okay, because when you say 32, sometimes people listening are thinking about like content websites and you know, monthly multiple. Some digital assets, and you know, digital assets typically under $1 million get, you know, valued at 30 out of a monthly you know, multiple. But when you say 32 annual EBITDA, that's, what sort of business was that?
Insane. So that was because that had a lot. So there's a lot of things that build value in that one, and that's unusual. Just to be clear, that's not normal. Most people are getting four or five times multiples typically. But if you build the right team, and this is the bit I see that most people don't do, right? So the first thing I would say to clients, if you buy a business, it should have a team. It might have two or three people. It might have outsourcers. The first thing we encourage them to do is to profile everybody on the team. And the reason you do that is because you're very quickly going to understand who you're working with, what their strengths are, what their weaknesses are, and how to best manage them for them to, you know, and which ones are likely to wobble because of their profile that they won't like change and they'll be nervous and worried. So the first thing I always say to clients is, look, in the first month, we should profile everybody and understand, have we got the right people in the right seats? Because most businesses probably may or may not have that. And secondly, how do you manage and motivate the people that you've got? And rather than take 6 months to learn about them, why don't you profile them and you'll learn about them in a, you know, in the space of a few days. And they're going to feel like you invested in them because you went, look, I'm going to invest in you to understand you, to learn you, learn about you, and to help you be able to be more successful in your job role. Wow. As a member of that team, whether I'm an outsourcer or not, I suddenly feel more valued. And when someone's buying a business, they are buying, if you are what's called a cog in the wheel. So if you are the cog through which all decisions have to flow, it's very hard to exit that business without some kind of earn out or lock in for 2 or 3 years, because people go, yeah, but if we take you out of the business, nobody knows everything. So your job is to actually make yourself redundant. Sorry?
They call it key person dependency.
You're absolutely spot on. Yeah. They do. And if we take the e-com client of mine for an example with this, one of the things we're doing at this stage of the business now, we're over 2 million, is we're starting to invest in talent. We're starting to bring on the next level of management that he needs to get out of boxes. So now that we've built the model, we know the model's profitable. We're now reinvesting some of that profit back into people so that we can start to get him out of any operational dependency, so that, as you said, he doesn't become key man dependent. So that then becomes a strategic move at this stage in the model, right? Like it wouldn't have worked a year ago because we weren't profitable enough to do it. Now that business is profitable enough, you go, okay, that becomes the next strategic move, is to start bringing in talent that can free up the CEO and the owner to get ready to grow the business, but also to focus on getting the business ready for potential exits, if that's the strategy, if that's what they want to do, right? The client I'm working with, that's not part of the next 2-year plan, but building a leadership team or a senior leadership team that can operationalize and run that business really efficiently is part of the next 12 months, 18 month strategy, because it builds so much value into the business, should we ever want to exit.
Yeah, I love that. So when there's so many things, it's going to be dependent on the business. They're going to be dependent on the owner of the business and what they actually want. But roughly how much time would you tell business owners and CEOs and entrepreneurs that they should budget for to get ready for an exit, to get rid of key person dependency, to make sure you can get the recurring revenue, or de-risk the business so the multiple can be increased at the time of exit. What's the rough sort of time frame? I mean, it's different for each business and goals for each one, but is there some, like, just giving some people, the listeners, something to think about when they want to exit?
Yeah. So that's a really good question, actually. I don't get asked it enough. The thing I say to most clients, I say, look, it's probably dependent on where you're at and what you have, and that's a variable. But it's probably 2 years to get your exit ready. Okay, it's probably 2 years. Now you might do it quicker than that, and you might have things in place, but it's probably 2 years to get your exit ready, to really optimize it, right? To get it into the best position to sell it. And then it's probably anywhere, to get the best price for it, right? And then it's between 6 and 9 months, anywhere up to a year to sell it. So people tend to think it's quicker to sell it. And 9 times out of 10, in my experience, it takes longer than they think. It's more complex to negotiate. Again, the bigger the multiple, the slower the sales cycle, right? So I say it's 2 years to build the team, get the P&L in the right position, in the right shape, to have, you've got to go back and look at, if you're going to sell the business, you've got to go back and look at all the contracts that you've ever signed with customers. You've got to look at all the contracts that your team are under. Like, there's so much due diligence, and you still have to be growing the business during that phase, right? And this is the bit where people, I'll share you this, because we've lost deals too. I just want to be clear with people. Like, we've had people who've had deals and they've lost them or they've blown them. And I'll tell you why in a minute if you want to know. But the reason most exits fall over, based on the research and the data and the people that we've talked to in this world, the reason why most exits fall over is because the revenue drops during the negotiation period. So it might be 9 months you're negotiating to exit this business. And because you're distracted, you haven't been focused on driving the business. 9 times out of 10, it's because you haven't put a good COO in place to drive it. But because you're distracted over here, we're trying to sell it. And it's a full-time job trying to sell a business, right? It takes a lot of effort and time and negotiation and due diligence and legal fees and all that stuff. If halfway through that, your revenue has dropped by 30% because you were focused over here, that will normally kill the deal. At the very best, they're going to come back and negotiate you down on price. That's what we call the risk zone. Right? It's a massive risk zone.
And the risk zone when selling. It's really good to explain it that way.
It happens. We had, like, And this is, and this happened recently. A client of mine had a really, really great offer on the table, multiple seven-figure offer. And then they had a contract with a national company, which was really valuable, but the contract came up for renewal during the exit negotiations, right? So straight away, the buyer said, we're not gonna sort of close this deal until we know that contract's renewed. It didn't renew. They lost it, which immediately absolutely crippled the valuation of that business. It meant the buyer was now not sure about all the other contracts they had, because if they lost that one, and it created doubt in the buyer's mind, and the buyer pulled out. And you go, okay, we got to go back around and rebuild the revenue. That's now, and I've said to him, you got to dig in for 2 years now. It's 2 years to dig in, because we're going to have to go back and rebuild the revenue and come back to the market. And like, that's a 2 year, I've seen this, Jared, so many times, right? People spend the money mentally before they have it in the bank.
Isn't it? It's same on the acquisition side, Paul. People acquire the business in their head and live the lifestyle in their head that they perceive they're going to have as a business owner with all this money, and forget, like, hey, I bought the business and I've actually got to do some work here.
Well, that's because most people aren't investors, right? If you're an investor, you'd be buying it knowing that and putting a team in place, and then you could do that. But I've seen it where people get so excited that they've already planned out how they're going to spend the money, where the holidays are they're going to take. And I'm like, it's not done until the money's in the bank. Just no. Stop doing that, because otherwise it just hurts. A lot of deals fall over in due diligence, because you know, no matter how good you think your business is, you've got optimism bias. You've got that optimism bias about how great your business is, right? And then a buyer looks at your business and goes, yeah, but that contract's not in place. You know, this bit's not right. That bit isn't solid. You're using old tech for that. They start looking at your business like, what's wrong with it? And you don't, right? You look at it with what's right with it, because you're selling it. So that mismatch creates a massive bit of friction in the middle. And anytime you get, I'll give this tip out for everyone. Anytime you get your accountants involved with negotiating the exit, you are really putting a lot of risk in the deal, because most accountants are not used to the M&A world and don't understand it. And they also have an invested interest in their client not selling, right? Because if their client sells the business, they lose a customer. So like most accountants mess deals up. Sorry to say it, but it's true.
Yeah, they can. And also, you know, you've got to pay your accountant all this work. Then you've got to pay for your legals on the acquisition. And then you've got a 6 to 12 month time frame of you focusing on getting all the documentation and everything presentable for the acquisition side to do their due diligence. You've lost that 6 to 12 months if the deal falls over. It's not just, you haven't just lost revenue in the business, but you've lost 6 to 12 months of work. Has gone as well. So you would obviously advise people to keep running until they're past the finish line whilst adding extra workload with DD. Yeah.
The best thing you can do if you're in the sales process is because if I'm buying your business, I'm buying future revenue, right? So like if you can come back to me, and the other thing that causes deals to fall over, and it's shocking, but it's true, is bad financial information. Like the amount of times in due diligence you find out stuff. Yeah. Like most people haven't got really good financial data. Like they haven't got really good P&Ls. They're not running good cash flow forecasts. If you can rock up and say, hey, look, here's our 3 year cash flow forecast. Here's our last 5 years profit and loss. Here's our balance sheet currently. And like, if you're a buyer, you're going to sit there and go, wow, this is unusual, because it is, right? Most people's financial data is the thing that takes the time to sort out. Like, especially if the business is over $2 million, I'll always bring in an external accountant to start, you know, kind of like an FD to start tidying up all the accounts and stuff and making it presentable, because you've got to make it presentable to the buyer. And that can take 6 months. Like just doing that can take 6 months, because you've got to go back through the last 2 or 3 years accounts and, you know, they were probably built for profit. They're built to minimize tax and maximize lifestyle. So you've got lots of offsets in there. And now you're trying to position the business to maximize value on exit. You've got to go back and look at all the accounts, and that takes 6 months. And this is the stuff that causes people to lose energy during the process. Because most entrepreneurs have love to move. I know about you, but I'm this. I love to move fast, make decisions, get stuff done, make it happen quick, right? And selling a business is one of the slowest, most frustrating things you will ever do. And like, you have to master patience. If you want to go on a course on mastering patience as an entrepreneur, try selling your business, because it will absolutely teach you that.
Yeah, definitely. And you're not just dealing with one person that might want to buy it. You know, it could be multiple people. So, you know, Paul, we could chat all day, but I'm so grateful for everything you've shared. And I know that you've got so much you could share with. Maybe we do another podcast.
Hey, YouTube watcher, if you thought that video is good, you should check out this video here on the two best types of websites beginners should buy. Or check out my playlist on how I made my first 100K from buying websites and how to do due diligence. Check it out. It's an awesome playlist. You'll enjoy it.